Welcome, everyone, to episode 43 of Cast Your Calls with Zombie Grub. I am here with the one and only DJ Wheats, one of the most OG guys in esports and one of my personal favorite commentators back in the day of StarCraft. And you can tell I'm maybe fangirling a little bit here, but yeah, thank you so much for coming on, DJ Wheat. You have so much experience in the industry across so many parts of it as well as now you got to do all like the more behind the scenes into Twitch. It's a historic career at this point, and I assume you're just gonna keep on going. But I always start off with, of course, the usual, like, hey, how you doing, and then get a little bit about how you got in esports, which I know is a bit farther back than some other people, but I'm really looking forward to hearing about it.
Awesome great. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So when we think to esports and the start of it, some people in this podcast, listening to this podcast, they think of maybe Brood War, maybe. A lot of them think certainly StarCraft 2. A lot of my fans are StarCraft 2 fans. Mm-hmm. And very few get to go, you know, beyond Brood War or into kind of the other esports that were happening at that time. But that's actually where you were coming from. So straight from the source, what was the pre-current era of esports like for you?
Yeah. So I would say that like late 90s, early 2000 era is kind of what you're referring to. And it's funny because Zombie, I don't even think we were actually calling it esports back then, right? I think that we were just calling it pro gaming or professional gaming. And I have the same road that a lot of other casters have, where I played Quake 3 like just all the time, every waking moment, every waking hour. I played quote unquote professionally. The most I ever won was about $1,200 and mostly team competitions. But that's kind of where I got my start. I just had a love for competition that started well before that. For me, actually, my love for competition really started with fighting games. It was like me versus my brother in everything. And eventually I just kind of, you know, eclipsed him. And that's where I think the competitive fire really came from. So along came a little game called Quake, and then Quake 2, and then Quake 3. And that's really where I started building, a competitive resume per se. But what happened then was what I think happens with a lot of folks too, in that I needed to get a job. I had less time to play Quake, but I loved the game so much and I loved what was happening in the community that I just could not walk away from it. So for me, the way to stay in the scene was to figure out like how to do that. It first started as a coach. It wasn't even as a caster. I was with a team that I'd created called Clan 519. And I said, okay, I'm going to be coach. I know how you all play. I know our teams. And believe it or not, my first broadcast was actually just me recording commentary, which was more or less like bitching and moaning to the team, because we all had weird schedules. I couldn't always be there for the actual like scrims and whatnot. So I would watch their demos and then I would record a wave file and say, okay, you know, Gator, you should have been at quad damage. You were like 10 seconds too late. If you'll see here, everyone comes in from the middle area of DM6 and you mess this up. And next time, everyone should be there when people start spamming that quad is up. So I kind of did this time after time. And eventually one of my teammates came to me and said, his name was Air Dave. He came to me and said, you should do a live version of what you do when you coach. Because basically you're kind of treating it like it was a sporting event, right? You're kind of giving the play by play and the color. And so I was like, hey, that actually sounds like that might be a lot of fun. And that is kind of how I sort of stumbled into the world of casting, figured out what technology we needed. My original broadcast was on Real Audio, which I think had a 25 person capacity at the time. I actually went to, this is nutty, but I actually went to Best Buy and bought a box that was real audio. And in it, with the it was actually the player, but in it was also the broadcaster. So like went, spent $25, installed real audio, set up a little server, and I guess, you know, kind of the rest is history.
It's like the most original of history too. I love the history of esports and especially StarCraft II, which is good because they kind of go along together, but listening to really the creation of esports commentary is so, it's crazy to me actually. When you started doing this, that particular portion of it, I guess the whole like actually getting it set up and kind of thinking about it as commentary, did you have anyone that you were looking to? Were there peers that were kind of doing the same thing around the same time and you were like, oh, that's good, like let me try that? Or were you looking towards traditional commentators from traditional sports?
I mean, I don't even know. There was no one around at the time. I mean, people weren't really doing this. And not saying that it hadn't been done, but I wasn't really exposed to it. So for me, I was just, you know, I genuinely love competitive gaming to the point where it just, it gets me so excited. And that is where, you know, my source of inspiration was. It's just like, just be as excited as you are when you used to play or when you would watch your team play or two, you know, people play. And I think I've always just been someone who's really appreciated that there are so many more people out there that are better at this game than me. And I want to spotlight them because I love this game. I love this competition, etc. Now, I would say that once I realized what I was doing and that I was kind of, you know, not fantastic at it, I think I probably had just enough passion to get by. And people were like, all right, this guy gets excited whenever there's a mid-air rocket and a rail. This is great. Because I would imagine that the people that were tuning into that stuff were exactly like me. They were just excited about what they were seeing, excited that this player was facing this player, this team was fighting this team. I did eventually start to realize that if I wanted to improve, firing into the dark was probably not the best way to do it. So I did spend a lot of time when I was younger listening to AM radio. And that's how I constructed a lot of what I was doing. But I ended up reading, you know, some books and paying more attention. And I was not much of a sports guy up to this point. But that was the thing that got me to start realizing, well, there's no reason to reinvent the wheel here. Like someone obviously has done this before. Like all of the great commentators of sports have done this before. Not saying that we need to mimic them or do exactly what they do, but there's probably a lot to learn from those individuals. So I would say that eventually, you know, over that course of that first year, it went from really like flying by the seat of my pants to let's actually start paying attention to, you know, some of these other individuals, how they're casting games, like what, how, you know, how they tell the story basically is mm-hmm. kind of what I felt like my role was as a caster. And so I kind of did what I could to educate myself in that regard.
I do think that a very kind of the easiest way to be considered at least like an interesting commentator is to just, you know, kind of let your passion shine. People like that, you know, even if you're not the most mm-hmm. analytical or even necessarily the most well-spoken, people just really like listening to when people nerd out and get excited. Yep. So I think that's, you know, kind of, that's the baseline. And then there's all these other things that go on top of it, like you're saying. Now, you know, looking at the, all these years over, do you think that it's still worthwhile for esports commentators to look at the traditional broadcasters, or are there enough examples in esports that it's better to look there?
I think it's a combination of both, to be honest with you. To say that, you know, there's not things that you could pick up from watching traditional sports broadcasts, so it would be a mistake. I'll give you an example. When I was first starting to kind of learn how to cast Counter-Strike, right? A lot different pacing than a game like Quake, which is kind of like, well, the moment the buzzer starts, it's just action, 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 action. And believe it or not, I watched a lot of golf to understand how something slower paced, how do you, right, fill in the blanks? How do you tell the story? Because realistically, you're not going to have a constant peak of excitement like you would in a game like Quake, especially like a team deathmatch where the action just it doesn't stop. So from that perspective, could you learn some of that by watching the great Counter-Strike commentators and analysts of today? Absolutely. But if you think about, again, going back to I believe that the role of a commentator in esports is to really kind of tell the story. Sometimes that story slows down a little bit and builds excitement and you're building towards something. Sometimes it's just like nonstop action across the board. And so one of the things that I picked up from the different disciplines of regular sports was how your voice, your inflection, your excitement, your tone, your volume, how those all affect the story that you ultimately are trying to tell. So I think that the best way, whether you're getting in now or you are getting in 20 years ago, is obviously look at what's around you, right? Understand what the community might want, what traditionally flies for different esports, because that can be a little bit different depending on what you're actually calling or casting or hosting, et cetera. But that there's always room to grow. And there are so many greats in the sports world that you can learn from. It seems silly to me to not at least consider that as a way to expand your own capabilities.
And when we start to get into commentary, I feel like talking to my peers, talking to people on this podcast, all the well-established commentators, they kind of go to stories really quickly, to storylines really quickly. But I would say actually a lot of them agree that it wasn't necessarily the thing that they thought of first, commentary being storytelling. So you're saying you kind of figured that part out pretty early on in your career, which would also be back in like the 2000s too, right? So
yeah.
One of the first ones kind of focus in on that. Do you agree that that is actually like the most important thing to focus on? That's really what we are, storytellers.
You know, I personally, and I understand some people might say like, nope, that's not, but yeah, absolutely. I think that, let me explain why I mentioned Counter-Strike, and it was such a interesting thing to go from a high-paced, never-stop Quake 3 to a much more controlled pace Counter-Strike, right? And the reason why that storytelling became so important to me in that transition was because I realized that you were effectively telling like five stories within one. Right. You're telling the story of the overall tournament and competition. Then you're telling the story of the current match that you're watching. Then you're telling the story of the current half that you're in. Then you're telling the story of the round that you're in. And then you're telling like almost a macro story of why all of this matters together. And you can imagine having that many threads in a story, it could get kind of confusing, and that maybe there's some times where you need to emphasize certain aspects of the story. Also, what this leads to is the idea of building a narrative, right? The best matches that we watch are those ones that, you know, when it starts 0-0, no one knows who's going to win, right? And when one team pulls ahead, you start to tell the story of like, how does this other team come back? And then if they start to come back, then you equalize that story and create a new point in which you're kind of reflecting on and trying to build towards. And sometimes as storytellers, we're wrong. We are wrong, but that's sometimes what makes for the best cast that you do. It's like you're telling one story, it's going this way, and like, oh my gosh, actually, no, what an amazing comeback. No one saw the snipe of that Dark Shrine, and now suddenly, right, the story changes. So the ability to pivot and the ability to kind of like redirect that story. So that's always why I kind of tend to lean more towards the storytelling aspect. And why I think that's beneficial is as I begin to expand into even more games, whether that was Warcraft 3 or Brood War, or, you know, you'd be asked to like, you know, you'd be at some random competition. They'd be like, we need you to cast Tony Hawk Pro Skater. And you're like, okay, I've never done that before. Let me figure out how to tell a story, even though I know nothing about this game. And that was kind of the secret to unlocking the how do I cast X game. And that has never failed me, Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's often why I say storytelling is to me the really just the core of what, you know, casters are doing. And that might change a little bit depending on if you're the host or if you're the analyst or you're doing play by play or you're talking on a group panel. Everyone's contributing that story in a way, shape or form. And I think especially if you are a caster that's moving from game to game to game, the story you tell in Quake is going to be totally different than the story you tell in StarCraft. And if you try to tell Quake stories in StarCraft, people are going to be like, what? Wait, this doesn't make sense, right? And so understanding how each game has its own story and how that story unfolds, I think is like the easiest way to pick up new disciplines as a caster.
I think it's what kind of draws people in, right, is that often the storytelling also kind of is it brings us to the human part of the story. A lot of the storytelling is about the right. human that's performing, and people are, as a social species, like, you know, more attracted to that idea. So the guy losing 7 times in a row finally wins one is so much more important than whether it was in Quake or StarCraft or anything,
right?
So it's been really quite, it was a very, I don't know, like almost validating in a way to hear you break down everything like that in such a nice manner as well. Cause I've tried to explain this process as well and you did it fantastic. But I always think about, like, you know, I'd say that for build orders in StarCraft, we have very specific build orders and you sound really smart when you can knock the build order out of the park. But then if you can't contextualize it, I think that's where you see the analysts who are kind of naturally talented to be on camera versus the analysts who are just, they really do just repeat numbers. And you're like, well, what's the context here?
Right.
But it's, you know, it's amazing to hear that this was developed weirdly enough. Like it felt like it was developed in esports so early on. But then as I said, like so many commentators say, that's a bit thing, something I kind of learned a little bit later on, or they realized that they were doing a little bit later on. So at some point, you know, you are getting into this esports commentary thing and it's actually growing to, you know, a decent size, especially with the onset of StarCraft 2 and Twitch. When you started getting a lot of peers, I don't know if that was when you started getting a lot of peers doing the same thing or not, but when that started happening, when you were like, this guy commentates a lot, did you have a lot of like talking sessions with anyone that you kind of, did you feel like a mentor in any way, or did you kind of come together with the group at some point and realize, oh, we're kind of figuring this out together?
So I know we kind of went from Quake and Counter-Strike and fast forward to StarCraft 2, but I think like everything that happened in between is the answer to your question. Because, you know, earlier on, right, we didn't have video broadcasting. So we were broadcasting what would be considered the radio era of esports, right? We used something called Nullsoft Shoutcast. It was built by the same individuals that created Winamp. It's still used today in a lot of different capacities. But that was right how we broadcast it. Now, back then, individuals, right, we might have our own channel, or a tournament might have their own channel. But the way it worked is that we had coverage groups, right? First, I joined a coverage group called TSN, Team Sportscast Network. And, you know, while I really enjoyed my time there, I had a completely different philosophy when it came to casting, what the role of an organization is, like what I felt like the ceiling for esports was. So I ended up and started my own shoutcast group, as we called it. It was called Radio Inside the Game, Radio ITG. That later on I adapted to be a show for StarCraft II. But that's where, you know, what I was doing is I was trying to just find broadcasters that I felt like were as passionate about the games that they loved and played as I was. I think on accident, I kind of became a mentor. And right, some of the people that joined ITG over the 2000 to, like, you know, before to pre-Twitch era were Tasteless, Red Eye, Tosspot. We had, gosh, now I'm like, why can I think? I mean, oh, Vancilli was, who now does Valorant, was a part of it. So, there were a lot of individuals that I got a chance to work with in those early years, I would hope that I was a mentor to them. I mean, I learned just as much from them as I think they learned from me, in terms of like managing people and keeping people happy and making sure that like everyone got a fair shot and that everyone got felt, you know, like they were had an opportunity to be in the spotlight. And but that was a lot of time in which we as a coverage group spent time talking about how we do this, how important chemistry is when it comes to pairings. So in an interesting way, because it was audio only and because it was radio and because a lot of what we were doing was lacking a video component to it, I felt like we had an even more difficult job of telling the story. And that's why we focused on a lot of it during that time. So I think the answer to your question is like, yeah, through Radio ITG specifically, you know, I felt like we were able to build a really passionate casting group that eventually went on to, you know, do great things once video and live streaming became a thing, which obviously was big for esports. But that was an era that I'm very fond of. And, you know, frankly, I feel like I kind of, you know, figured out my own style and hopefully helped others sort of figure out a style in that journey that we all took together.
It's awesome to hear about, because I've even discussed some of the things you're talking about with other people as far as the idea that we didn't really come as much from the radio era as, say, traditional broadcasters do. So, you know, you read a book about traditional broadcasting and there's a lot of snippets about make sure that you always say the score like every so often, because you have a lot of radio listeners even today, but that's where they came from. But, you know, esports didn't have at least as much of a face where it was just radio. But it seems like your transition was seamless. Like I'd still say that esports does not really cater to radio broadcasting. We often just are assuming that someone is watching, and we're mostly correct on that. But there was no difficulty for you, by the sounds of it, to kind of go from radio broadcasting to video broadcasting.
So when I was growing up, I spent a lot of time in the car with my father. He listened to a lot of AM radio. And when I started at college, actually broadcast journalism was a minor. I was doing computer science, computer engineering, and then broadcast journalism because I really loved talk shows. I really loved, you know, one of my absolute sort of role models is Art Bell. And, you know, he passed away in 2014, but he has this legendary broadcast career. Granted, he talks about ghosts and aliens and all sorts of weird shit, but I loved it, right? And what I always appreciated about Art Bell was like how he told stories and how he handled callers and how he got information out of people. And that was always so fascinating to me. I was like, man, I want to go study that. But a thing happened there in like 1996 when I started studying this is that the internet came around and I suddenly started to realize that, man, radio's kind of lame because it has a limited audience, but the internet is going to have an unlimited audience eventually. And so that's why I kind of made that initial conversion. So I kind of already had an affinity for radio. It was something I was interested in. I took everything that I had learned in that and really applied it. I think I really can't tell you. I can hardly even remember the transition from audio to video. I remember the first video event we did. It was QuakeCon 2003. It was a Doom 3 competition. We used Nullsoft video. It was crap. It was terrible, but we did it, right? There was a desire, obviously, that if esports was going to grow, it was going to need to graduate from audio to video. And so I guess I personally didn't really think about that much at the time. I saw it more as a necessity for the survival of esports, right? Like this is the direction it inevitably is going to go. So you're either on board or you're off board, right? And I remember, I'm sure my initial video streams were probably a little awkward, but you know, what I would tell a lot of the people during Radio ITG is like, listen, we do this all the time. The only difference is that you're just looking into a camera in between, right, break and then coming back. And we tried to, you know, keep people in the comfort zone of it. As long as you do what you're going to do or what you would normally do, like be passionate about the game, talk about it the ways that we've been talking about it for years, the video part is almost not going to matter. Everyone's just going to be so happy that there's video that like it won't matter. They want to see the games, right, at the end of the day. So I don't remember much about that transition, but I do remember thinking that, you know, it was inevitable and it was kind of the direction that we had to go for esports.
All I can think of are the people in the 90s that were saying like internet's a fad.
Yeah.
And here you are calling it correctly, of course, that like, yes, it was absolutely the direction that it was going to head. It's you know, the whole casting group actually was new information. Oftentimes I'm asking questions where I know at least a little bit about the question I'm asking, just want to get your thoughts on it. I actually didn't realize that casting groups were a thing, but it does make sense. Are you kind of surprised that they, I guess, dissolved is the best word for it, and now maybe kind of in a way like agent? I'm trying to think of a word. Agencies. There we go.
Sure.
Kind of fill that role, or did you also see the cast of groups dissolving as kind of a natural thing?
I feel like it was a pretty natural evolution because you kind of have to look at what the status quo was back in the early 2000s, right? Like, could I have created a Quake network? Sure, absolutely. But my audience would have been limited to Quake. Mm-hmm. So because of the ways that, you know, we were covering a lot of online cups, we were covering more than one game, it made a lot more sense for a group to come together and sort of be able to fill the airtime with different games, different cups, different leagues, depending on the day, depending on the time, etc. The other thing that made a lot of sense is because we were all looking for growth in the world of esports, there was the possibility of crossover audience. Like, sure, this person might have been a Quake fan, but then there's a Counter-Strike match on next, and that would give us as casters the opportunity to say, like, hey, you know, Vancillion Sin are coming up next. They've got a Cal I match that they're going to be doing between these two teams. You know, stick around, tune in, and then there would be a natural transition. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I do believe like that was really important for that era of esports. But then as the TO scene and the league scene started to change, I understand why we don't particularly have that now, right? Because ESL or, you know, another group might, like, they're probably going to be running their own productions. And so the idea of back then, a broadcast group kind of going to a tournament organizer and say, let us come to your event and broadcast, it kind of turned into the world that we see today, where the individual leagues are kind of responsible for the broadcast, and those who are in the community doing those things, hired hosts, casters, analysts, etc., are just being hired and brought in to kind of fill the talent for the broadcast that exists. So I do think that it was necessary for that era of esports, because otherwise it would have been too fragmented. There would have been very little growth, and it just wouldn't have been putting the best foot forward, I think, in that time.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Did you have any? It sounds like there was just kind of a free for all for caster pairings. You kind of just were like, you and you were available for this game. Go do the thing. Is that true? Or did you kind of stick with a co-caster more often than not?
I think that the way it kind of broke down for the most part was casters kind of declared themselves as I want to cast these games, right? And someone might be like, I'll do anything FPS, or like, I'll do anything RTS, or, you know, I want to dabble in both. And I think one thing that was good about the broadcast teams that we've talked about, like TSN and ITG, was that it gave us the opportunity to really fine tune chemistry in a lot of ways. So the two broadcasters that I was most famous for casting with in the early Quake days were actually a gal named Trillian and another named DA. And they came from the Quake scene. And, you know, we ended up building like a really, really fantastic chemistry together. And so, right, when people, even I do Quake still on the weekends, and people are like, oh, I miss the old cast between DJ Wheat and Trillian. And, you know, like I it's so interesting because we never ran into an issue of like, listen, your guys' chemistry sucks. You know, one of the things that I always taught, even in the early days, is that one of the most powerful skill sets that you can have as a caster is your ability to fuse with another caster, is your ability to supplement strengths and weaknesses as needed, right? The more that you can mold to what the your co-caster is, the more successful you're going to be. And it shouldn't matter what casting pair you are put into, that you should be able to identify, okay, here's what that person's really good at. I need to be really careful and make sure we're not like doubling up roles. And so that's something that we worked a lot on early on. And I'm very thankful and grateful to the team for that too, because I think for me, that let me in the later years of esports, like come in and know like, okay, I've never casted with this person before, but I've heard them cast many times and I know what kind of caster they are. So I'm going to try to fit the mold of what the other right caster needs to be. Mm-hmm. I still believe this to be very, very true. And I think that like if any broadcaster, if anyone in this talent space is looking like on ways to improve, that is like hands down one of the most incredible things that you can do for yourself.
It's interesting you say that actually. So first of all, I always thought that, yeah, you seemingly picked up whatever was thrown at you, which back in the day was like everything. But even when things got kind of more like constrained to an actual role, like you're hired for this or that, you seem to just jump into it really nicely. Don't remember any issues with any co-commentators either. I always thought that you were, yeah, definitely one of the best to kind of just fit wherever was necessary. People give Artosis a lot of credit for that nowadays too, just kind of fitting with any commentator.
I agree.
Doing a fantastic job. But it's interesting you're talking about this being a really good skill to have, because I don't disagree. But I also know that I'm very much in a specific situation where in StarCraft, we're still kind of the free-for-all. You know, like we get paired based on, you know, raise your hands, you want to cast this best of three.
Right.
Where so many other esports, especially the more kind of like mainstream, if you will, they get, the more they're pushing duos. So, right. You know, with all you just said in mind, I mean, do you think that this is a strength, a weakness? Do you think that it's kind of a moot point? Like, you know, they do what they do, whatever, whatever. Or, you know, a lot of people just consider duos being a necessity, actually. Like, you should be much better with one person than just a bunch of other randos.
I mean, we as humans are obviously going to be inclined to want to be with a person that we feel very comfortable with, right? Great. That we're human. That is completely natural. However, in the world of esports, that in my 20 plus years, like I haven't stuck with one game. I believe that the future of esports for especially talent is that you better not believe that your game's going to be around forever. And so, look, I'm not going to say that caster pairs are a mistake, right? And they're gonna have a disadvantage, but you know they will, right? Like if you right, you mentioned Artosis, and Tasteless and Artosis are like this legendary casting pair, but Tasteless can cast with other people, and Artosis can cast with other people. Like they both very much have that skill. They both know where they need to fill in and pick up as well. Not saying that other talent and other games don't have similar skills, but I would say that you absolutely can get so comfortable with the talent that you struggle when you suddenly get paired with someone that isn't like your, you know, your life casting partner. So absolutely, even if you are in that situation, being able to be more versatile will mean that you are going to have a very long, fulfilling career, because it won't matter what situation you're put in. I like give one of my favorite examples of where, you know, like chemistry came in pretty big. I want to talk about the late, great Total Biscuit, because Total Biscuit and I are very similar when it comes to casting, right? Very, very similar. Both telling a story, both very much like able to bring the hype, telling a macro story. So we for a lot of times during like MLGs and stuff, we would kind of, you know, gentleman's agreement, like, we're so similar, like it probably doesn't make a ton of sense for us to be casting side by side. But you can imagine that the community was like, can we get a Wheaton Total Biscuit cast? Like, come on, let's go, let's go. And I remember sitting down with John and like, well, Wheats, it's finally happening. We're going to do it. And I'm like, at this point I'd worked with John in the past and he was around in the early internet radio days too. So, you know, it was our ability to recognize that, like, hey, listen, we're pretty much the same caster. So, you know, let's do this. And right, our approach was like, first off, let's not change that, but let's know that, you know, if you're sitting next to Day Nine, you're going to like ask him that analytical question, right? To kind of like bring the story to a point. And like, let's not do that to each other, right? Let's just go in and have fun with it and know that we are basically the same person doing a cast together. So we knew that obviously people were not going to get the most in-depth analysis that they've ever seen, but because we were able to identify that, and because we were both pretty good at sitting down and molding to who the other person was, that to me was actually one of the most like successful casting pairs where, you know, that it's when someone's different, you've got to figure out like, how do I supplement their weaknesses and how could they supplement like my weaknesses? But in that situation, it was, how do we still make sure we're delivering a good product when we're essentially like the same people, even mm-hmm. though that's not what the broadcast is expecting. So roundabout way, yes, it's super important. Yes, casting pairs are awesome. I, you know, obviously I have my favorites in my career as a caster. And sometimes you cast with people for so long that it's so natural. But the best skill that I have in my tool set is the ability to sit down with someone who I've never casted with before and then realize like, okay, this is what they're doing. This is kind of their style. This is their cadence. And so I am going to, you know, archon with them in a way that is going to make the most sense instead of just being like, well, this is how I cast and this is how I'm going to keep casting regardless of who I'm sitting next to.
Yeah, there are some. There's some people who I guess you could say know what they're good at, but then also you could say is they're a bit inflexible.
Sure.
They can be tough to work with, but yeah, excellent points. So you're talking about, you know, sitting down with a co-caster, talking to them and really putting a lot of thought into the why and how of the cast. Can you talk a little bit, I guess, specifically around the StarCraft II era? So like, let's say the big boom of esports is 2010, 2011. What was the atmosphere like in a lot of those tournaments? I know there was like a billion of them, but did you find that you all had like a shared interest in the why and how of the craft, or was it a lot more of just StarCraft?
Gosh, that's a great question. You know, specifically in that era, I think that like for me, and for many others, right, we'd already been on this journey, right? I would say, shit, by the time like StarCraft, right, like I felt pretty damn good at my craft. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but like, I remember watching the first MLG StarCraft II event and being like, oh my God, like, you know, I've been playing a lot of StarCraft II. Like, I want to do this so badly. So I actually reached out to MLG and I begged them. I just said, listen, let me just come out. I will work for you for free all weekend. I just want to show you what I could bring to the broadcast and what I, you know, and how much I want to be able to support and get behind what you're doing. And so Ben and Sundance are like, okay, you know, like we've known you, we've worked with you in the past, like let's give it a shot. And I went and did it and then worked every MLG event after that. So for me, I felt like I was able to bring a lot of my experience and a lot of my storytelling to, you know, to MLG and to StarCraft II and to really try to push that. Not saying that other people weren't doing it, but I was like, I know that based off of what my skills are that I can enhance this broadcast. So for me, you know, it was absolutely important to me. And I think it was important for many others, but you also have to understand that in these early years of MLG and StarCraft II and DreamHack, and there was also just such an unadulterated excitement of the fact that finally StarCraft II and finally, you know, given its legacy with Brood War, but also you had the intersection of Twitch and live streaming and these audiences, and MLG was bringing a lot of spectators that we hadn't really seen before in the United States. And, you know, DreamHack was doing it over in Europe. And, you know, it was, look, I'm not going to paint some picture like, yeah, after every single day we sat around and we had a frosty beverage and we talked about the philosophies of casting. Nah, that didn't happen. A lot of times that would happen after the fact, right? Whereas like I'm talking to day nine and, you know, right, way out, like 3 days or a week after the event ended. And we're just like, yeah, you know, like I felt really good that tournament. Was there anything, you know, like we could have done better? Or did you like the way that we kind of did this? Or did you have any issues with, you know, when I kind of set up these questions for you or tee that up? You know, and usually it was like, nah, everything was great, right? Those discussions typically had to happen when it was sort of two casters meeting and casting for the first time. And even then, I think the discussions were really civil and kind of like respectful. So there was definitely talk of the craft, but I think also there was just so much excitement that it was just like, this was the moment, right? So you could imagine how much, though, that fueled what we were doing on the caster desk. Right. Mm-hmm. That like we felt like we had an obligation to talk about how amazing these players were, to tell the stories. And also, frankly, with MLG specifically, we had something to prove. Right. We wanted to prove to MLG that, yes, StarCraft II deserves to be here. We want to bring the crowd. We want to hype and create the excitement. Right. They knew they could do that with Halo. They knew they could do that with Gears of War. But here was our chance to really like make MLG go, holy shit. We love StarCraft II. And I mean, I definitely feel like that early casting team, you know, helped make that happen. I mean, there's a lot of passion within MLG people. They hired people that worked on production. But you know, I feel like that era was incredibly special, even for me who had already kind of been in it for 10 years. There was sort of a camaraderie and a, you know, foraging into the new world that was happening because of the video, because of Reddit, because of chat, because of all these things that were, you know, simultaneously almost like feedback loops as well. So yeah, there was just a lot going on in that era.
I feel almost like, I don't know, validated for being excited about Disneyland. You know, like I think back to those early years of StarCraft, and for me, yeah, it felt very magical because obviously it led to everything in my life, so it's very biased. But
yeah,
but it's I think a lot of people agree on it, and there's something more than just nostalgia for being younger, nostalgia for having the time to video games. There was something I think truly magical about that particular period, and I think everyone could feel it. And the casters absolutely were a part of it. I think, you know, so many of the caster personalities from that era in StarCraft went on to do pretty big and great things or be very important people behind the scenes or what have you. And it felt like so many people were larger than life is how I often describe them. And I come in you know, years later, and I hang around these people, and I just feel like a baby, basically. I watch Chaseless and Day 9 talk, you know, and it's like, yeah, I'm never going to be that charming. I'm never going to be that outgoing. Did you find that you had a lot of attention on yourself as a caster? Did you feel kind of like a celebrité, that you had to build a brand, that you were suddenly thrust into the world of entertainment, not just esports?
Yeah, a little bit, but at this point, I loved that, right? Like, I was kind of already doing that in the world of esports, right? Like, I mean, prior to this, I worked on Championship Gaming Series for 3 years, a defunct since 2009, like city-based league that was broadcast on DirecTV. So I got a lot of, experience in live television, which was both a blessing and a curse, because I realized, like, this isn't as fun as being on the internet, because, like, there are rules on the internet, but there's a lot less rules, right? Like, some of my favorite broadcasts were some of those, like, ridiculous late night MLGs where everyone's just so fucking tired after like 12 or 15 hours of broadcasting that, like, everything that everyone's saying is just absolutely hilarious, and it's just devolved into silliness. Like, those were some of my favorite times. So, you know, I think that the part that, I came to that and I felt very comfortable in all of that. I mean, it was really exciting that was kind of happening. And, you know, I remember a few of the threads that were like, you know, why are the, you know, like, shouldn't we be getting more players up there? And right. Like, there was a lot of this back and forth. And I certainly sympathized from a lot of different perspectives on all of that. But you mentioned something like larger than life, and I think that the talent of early StarCraft II was very revitalizing for me personally, right? I mean, I wouldn't say that I was getting bored at this point. Like, if I was in esports, like, I was, you know, even to this day, I'm still getting excited over the games I'm casting and things I'm hosting. But that was a real special time to, you know, and I casted a lot of games with Day 9. At that point, I'd like, you know, I originally met him back in Singapore at World Cyber Games 2005 when he qualified to go over there after beating Artosis in the USA finals. And it was just really interesting because it was like these two individuals, the Plot Brothers, that were this constant in my own esports career in some way, shape, or form. Like, I met that guy, I worked with it, I tried to convince Tasteless to go over to Korea, right? And then it kind of came full circle back to StarCraft II. And I felt so blessed to be a part of that. So, like, yes, absolutely, we saw it as entertainment as much as we saw it as esports and competition. Thankfully, I think the community deserves a lot of credit for, you know, supporting that level of entertainment, right? I mean, you look at something like, let's take, for example, Rocket League. I love Rocket League. I love watching it. They tend to tip their scales a little bit more towards the, like, serious professional. It's still gaming. It's still fun. People still crack jokes. It's still funny. But, like, no one, in my opinion, does it like it was done in that early 2012, 2014 era. Maybe it even tipped a little bit too much sometimes, but right. I always say when it comes to esports, like, look, at the end of the day, gaming is supposed to be fun. Right. And we talked earlier about, like, the comparisons between sports and between esports. And to me, that's the biggest differentiator between the two, is that I still think sports takes itself too seriously. And I love that esports is allowed to get a little wild, to get a little passionate, to get a little crazy, to be funny, to make sure that people are entertaining, because you're asking sometimes audiences to watch 3 days of coverage for 10 hours a day. Do that in the sports world and people are going to get bored really quick. The entertainment, I think, was a key ingredient not just in StarCraft, but in esports in general. I also love watching Dota. Dota is my other, it's basically Rocket League, Dota 2, and StarCraft 2 are like the three that I watch pretty religiously. And Dota, I feel, is very similar in that regard. Like, when it's time to break down and get serious, casters and hosts and analysts can do that. Mm-hmm. But when it's time to fill and get a little funny, they can do that as well. So I do think that that was a really great addition that I feel like during that era was truly kind of being defined by a lot of different casters and a lot of different, you know, organizations during that time.
I tell you, I was in university during that era, and my favorite thing was getting home Friday evening to watch 3 days of MLG. And I did watch like all of it. but you're right. It would never even cross my mind that traditional sports would even try that. But there was something about it that I really loved. A very greedy question from me, is very StarCraft related. So you still watch some StarCraft. Excellent to hear. Do you sometimes feel like we've also gone too professional? This is something that I've talked about with others. Other talent, talk about with Smix on her podcast interview, actually. And I keep saying that I think we kind of miss those highlight moments. You know, everyone remembers like Day 9 falling in his chair is always my go-to example. It just was something silly and impromptu, and then just it just happened and everyone remembers it. And now everything just, you know, when's the last time we saw something really like highlightable? You know, I'd say, you know, perhaps a bit unfortunately, like when In Control was casting, he gave you a lot of highlight moments because was one hell of a guy. But even he kind of started to get constrained by the WCS system back in 2016, right. 2017. Do you think that there's a certain point in like especially a longer esports life like StarCraft 2 that we kind of have to take a step back and reevaluate like what made us like good as far as the broadcasting potential? Is there a reason to go back to the more Home Story Cup roots in general, the more MLG roots, right? Or do you think that it's kind of a necessity what we're doing right now for like sponsorships and all that
phenomenal question. So to answer the first part of that, like, yes, I do believe that in some cases certain broadcasts have, you know, again, maybe not like tip the scales in terms of, you know, let's go ultra serious, but maybe just have tightened the grip, or I don't know how you want to analyze that a little bit. You know, maybe it's because sponsors have asked that, or maybe, right? But I think at the end of the day, it comes down to the audience, right? And, I mentioned that I'm still doing the Quake Professional League every Saturday. You know, I love the fact that I'm able to cast a game and players that I have been casting for over 20 years. And I feel like I immediately revert back to like old DJ Wheat Quake caster whenever I'm on those, right? Maybe with a little bit because they call me like Papa Wheat and, you know, a lot of old jokes and stuff. But I play off of that, right? And I can tell how much the audience loves that. They love it when I'm, you know, and I'm like, back in my day, right, we'd watch Cooler and it'd be over GTV and I can't believe this guy's still. So there's an element of that. But, you know, I think that, again, going back to that sort of fundamental thing is that, like, it's fucking video games, man. Like, they're supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be entertaining. Like, we should love the fact that we broadcast to audiences that won't mind if we are silly or make jokes, right? Like, we all know that we're capable of being serious when we need to be serious, right? When we're in game, when it's intense moment, no one is like derailing the broadcast by like, this is a perfect time to throw in this joke right here, right? I do feel like we need to remember that our roots are grounded in fun, are grounded in entertainment. And we have the opportunity to be different, to separate ourselves from regular sports. And I think that is one of the ways that we can do that. We don't need to be overly professional in order to grow esports, because esports has grown through, you know, this entertainment, funny, but still serious analytical breakdown as needed, right? So why wouldn't we really try to continue that? Because I think that if we lose the core audience, that's when esports like really starts, you know, I think having, I'm not going to say having problems, but I think that's when maybe people fall out of love with it, right? Mm-hmm. It's not what it used to be. I used to, you know, I remember when they used to like just crack jokes and be funny and do all this stuff and occasionally, you know, be whatever that might be. So like, I don't think we're in danger at all, but I do think that it is in everyone and esports in general's best interest to kind of evaluate how we're doing this. You know, I watch a lot of fighting game tournaments too, and look at them, right? They haven't changed a damn bit for the last, and I love it. It's great. They are who they are. They know who they're broadcasting to. And let me tell you, if there's one thing I've learned over 20 years, that's not deterring people from getting interested. If anything, it's making more people interested. So, right, like I say, go for it, unless there's like, you know, a sponsor wants it changed or wants to button it up or tighten it up. We as talent, as casters, as hosts, as whatever, right? Make sure you're operating within the, you know, the guidelines and criteria of what your whoever hired you wants you to do, but also, you know, feel empowered to go, this is video games. Like, this is fun. We're going to have fun. Let's go.
Yeah. I think it, yeah, sponsors sometimes have a, you know, an issue there. I also do believe that as if I'm trying to put myself in like production shoes, I know it is easier for them if we like hit a queue. You know, easy example is that when we don't introduce the player in StarCraft, we'll have like the producer in their ear and they'll be like, introduce. And
right.
They get in control. I had a big problem with that. but it is still something where I think of, I just feel like there's so many different ways of having a production. And that's the other thing I think that constrains the players and the casters is the setup, right? The literal setup, the literal, like you're three people standing next to the host and you're standing up and, you know, make sure the cameras, you know, look at the camera like that instead of two people on a beanbag chair, you know, drinking.
Right.
So I think I always point out that I believe Blast had this little after talk show kind of segment on CSGO where they would be around in a bar and mm-hmm. I'd be kind of drinking beers and they have mics holding. And I thought that that was just so conducive to that environment, the chill, cool friends talking environment that, you know, frankly, I think at the end of the day, really just comes down to someone in charge saying, you know what, we should change things up. We don't have to take the same set to every single place that we go and do the same thing, which I know is effort, manpower and all that good stuff. But yeah, I'm glad to hear that it's the passion in your voice for getting back to the roots of the fun was absolutely there.
Yeah, I mean, I think like to just sort of close it out, understand there's always going to be a balance, right? However, I will always push for trying to tip those scales a little bit, right? I do believe, and I've worked many times with TOs or sponsors that are like, they think that they want a more professional buttoned up cast or program or whatever. In reality, that's rarely what the audience wants. Mm-hmm. Right. So I do think it's important to note that, you know, the best talent is very versatile. They can go ultra professional if that's what's needed. And they also can, you know, get a little goofy if the opportunity presents itself. So I think we'll constantly be in search of that balance, but obviously I'd always like to tip the scales the other way.
Yeah, I like it. So again, perhaps a greedy direction I'm going to take here, a bit of a pivot. But you've been talking about hosting, you're talking about being versatile, and you talked about storytelling, talk about all these things. And all I could think of was like, you know, there's another reason why like Inside the Game, the show, the caster group was so good. I always think that StarCraft, since maybe Inside the Game and State of the Game, obviously, there hasn't really been the same type of talk show. Can you talk about making good talk show what are the elements that are missing from some of these other talk shows you might have seen sprung up and were kind of like, you know, okay. What made your talk show and State of the Game, do you have any comments on that, so interesting, so memorable?
The first talk show I ever created was a show called Epileptic Gaming. And it was all about video games. It's the longest running show that I've ever done. I started doing it as a radio only show in 2002. By 2006, it was a daily video show that we did over the internet before Justin TV, before Twitch. It was on a little site called Stick'em. And, the reason that I loved to do it was because I always felt like I needed an outlet to talk about the things that I love. And so for me, the talk shows have always come very easy because I'm just like, just let the floodgates open up and be passionate, right? So during Epileptic Gaming, everyone knew wasn't a big Xbox fan, was totally a big Sony fanboy. I'd talk about esports religiously, but my other hosts were just like, yeah, whatever, you're a nerd, all this stuff, right? But it just, for me, was an outlet to talk about the things that got me excited, that got me heated in it, you know, or that made me want to defend something or attack something, right? And so for me, the hardest part was, how do I get more people that share that, right, feeling and passion that would hop on board with me? I got really lucky with Epileptic Gaming. Two of my close friends were kind of perfect for those roles. And then that host and ended up expanding. You know, obviously when I started State of the Game, when I started Inside the Game, the original cast was Pain User, Idra, and Jeff in Control. And I mean, like, to me, that was perfection, right? I knew that In Control was going to bring the jokes. I know that we could get Idra all fired up about different topics. And like, I know that Pain User would just be this super chill guy that sometimes would take one side and sometimes take the other side. But like, the key to being successful, in my opinion, is to be unashamed, just let the passion flow. Right. I've taken this philosophy into my casting. I've taken it into my talk shows. I've taken it into my streaming that I do on Twitch. And it's truly the best version of yourself. I mean, I love passion so much. And if there's anything that, like, I don't care if you're talking about seahorses, if you are passionately talking about seahorses, you've got me. Like, I'm in it, I'm there. And I find that that's generally the case for most people. My favorite comment that I see during streams and stuff is like, I don't care at all about what you're talking about, but God, I love how passionate you are, right? And that to me, I know it seems so simple of an answer, but it's never steered me wrong. And I think that where maybe people have fumbled a bit is that you have to understand how to let your passion out. Because I do think that if you just try to force it out, that your audience, they're like, wait a second, like, this looks so, right? So there's no exact formula for how to make a successful show, but I think, you kind of ask like, why were these shows kind of, how did they stand kind of above some of the, I think a lot of it has to do with the cast and just the passion that existed in the cast. I did a show with Chill from Team Liquid called Weapon of Choice that was kind of the precursor to Inside the Game. And while I felt like that was always good, right, Chill and I had a sort of balance, but it was harder to pull some of that passion out of Chill, like arguably more than, say, Idra or In Control or Pain User. And so, right, that served kind of a different purpose. But even looking at State of the Game, you've got all these like famous stories that were like told on there that wasn't always about StarCraft. And I think that's like a similar thing. Live on 3 is no different. I'm rewatching Live on 3 like 13 years later. We just watched episode 3 and every Tuesday we're watching a new episode. But I'm by myself in the first few episodes. And like, you know, it's like, hey, you could tell this guy's passionate and occasionally a caller will come up, but like clearly there's a reason why Sir Scoots and Slasher ended up joining me is because I wasn't able to kind of carry that show on my own. And in some ways, having a single perspective was not going to carry a podcast or a talk show like that. So I think the two keys are let your passion be unleashed and then also find people who, you know, give a fuck as much as you do and want to share that passion with an audience in the exact same way. That chemistry and that formula, it won't matter what you talk about. What will matter is that, you know, people are hanging on to your every word because they love to see that passion. They, you know, love to see you get all worked up over some patch notes or a game that happened or whatever that might be.
Yeah, I think there is kind of a misconception throughout the years afterwards because no one I talked to had ever tried to really boil down what made the shows work. I do think that having like a consistent panel was one of the benefits, absolutely. Right. And you went over why there was such a perfect panel. But then also, I think the misconception that I was going to lead to, there was a misconception that, you know, the host had to be just an interviewer, I suppose, just someone who was there to kind of guide the conversation. But I always felt strongly that in both Inside the Game and State of the Game, you guys were equally part of the conversation. Yeah, you were leading, you were making sure to rein it in when necessary, but you had, as you're saying, like an equal amount of passion. You were equally interesting to everyone else on the podcast. Do you think that's true, or is that just a coincidence? Like,
I do think that's true, and I think it's necessary, right? Because ultimately what you just described is right, it's another element of chemistry. Yes, you need someone to drive the train, but if I as the conductor can go back to the food cart and be like, yeah, let's have a drink, like this is fun, right? Again, it all comes back down to like there's no rules that define how you need to do this. And I do agree that someone who is equally passionate about that kind of thing, that knows how to maybe press some buttons a little bit. And hey, it's a two-way street because like Jeff knew how to press my buttons so well. Like he just knew exactly how to just get me fired up. That constantly played off of, you know, we were able to play off of each other so much because of that. So like, yes, you have to take an active role. Otherwise, you're just the driver that is, right, getting people to point A to point B. And, you know, when you really break it down, a lot of over many, many years, you know, a lot of people like, I love Live on 3. I love Epileptic Gaming. I love Inside the Game. Why? What did you love about it? Because I just felt like I was hanging out with a bunch of buddies and maybe I wasn't contributing to the conversation, but it would be like a conversation I would expect to hear from my buddies. That's the best compliment I think that anyone could ever get, is that you feel so inclusive, you feel so welcoming that, you know, it has a cozy and comfortable feeling to it. It's not the easiest thing to accomplish. And I don't think I've ever accomplished it in, say, the first 10 episodes of any show. It takes time to develop. It takes time for that chemistry to simmer a little bit, for Jeff to know how hard can he press that button before Wheat is finally like, you know what, I'm done. This is over, right? Like that takes time. And so, you know, the other suggestion I would give is that if you're ever thinking about doing it, starting a talk show, like getting into that, like putting something together, know that your first 10 episodes are not there for you to master what the show is. The first 10 episodes are there for you to experiment, for you to try different things, for you to analyze, like, was it good? Was it bad? Are we trying to be too professional? Should we let things go off the rails a little bit more? And like your co-hosts, your audience, they're all indicators that are going to kind of let you know how that's going. But very rarely is any show out of the gate just going to be like, boom, they've hit it. They've mastered it. Everyone's chemistry is beautiful. It's perfect. It's great. It's just simply not the case. So you've got to work at that. It's something that, you know, you do really have to put some effort into.
Yeah. I think that's true for a lot of things too, by the way. Yeah. First video that you make on YouTube is pretty bad most of the time. Right. First cast is pretty bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's there to get the ball rolling. Yeah. And also to get a little bit of experimenting going too. So absolutely true. I wish I had a billion more hours to talk to you, but I know that we probably both have things to do. So we will be ending on the Patreon questions, which will push us over the edge a little bit, but it's just been such a fascinating episode.
I'm happy to give you the time. I'm in the audience the time for sure.
Thank you very much. So the first question is, what is something about people who hire talent slash the talent hiring process that most gaming talent don't understand or know about?
The people that are hiring talent, and what might be something they don't know. Well, I guess my initial thought is actually like, this is a tough question. My answer more or less goes to, as a talent, how important is that relationship with the individuals that, you know, that hire the talent. You know, what people probably don't know is that they typically have a lot of potential say in how your experience working at an event's going to be, if you might get rehired. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, I've always like told all of the casters I've ever worked with and stuff is that, like, listen, you know, production's your best friend. The people that hire you are the most important people at the event. That's where you really double down on professionalism. That's where you say please and thank you. That's where you don't act like a diva. That's where you, you know, you treat them how you would hope to be treated. I mean, just single-handedly that thing. I've often, Jeff used to always say this. He's like, Marcus, you're the... you know, the eternal diplomat, right? Like, I see you in these cases and you're always just like, and I'm like, Jeff, because it's the best way to have these relationships. And I'm not saying be fake, but I am saying, like, you know, and I've worked with some talent where I've just been like, damn, dude, I would never talk to someone on production that way. Like, that is a cardinal sin. But I really do think that it is such an important aspect. And I mentioned production too. And like, I'll tell you what, I've worked on the talent side. I've done many productions as well. And the best symbiotic relationship that exists, I know you know this, is that when your talent and your production is just like in tune. When you respect the production, they're going to respect you as talent, right? And that makes everyone's jobs easier. Mm-hmm. So I hope that kind of answered the question and was some insight, but that's kind of what immediately came to mind when I heard that.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree too. Like, part of the hiring process, it's not just one person. Like, it actually is very often not one person being right, like, right, that person is good. I listen to their cast and they like, actually it's, but also there's a surprising amount that truly the whole production has a say in it as well for some of these companies at the very least, where not just the person who's talking in your ear, but literally the cameraman, you know, if they're going to see that someone's a total douchebag behind the camera, they're going to talk to someone else who talks to someone else who talks to someone else.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of factors, but and you know, good news is it all boils down to being a good person to a degree.
That is exactly right. Like, I know that I made it an effort every single event that I went to. I would thank as many people. Thank you so much for letting me come out and work for you at this event. I had a blast. If there's anything that I could do in the future for you, or if there's anything I could do to improve, please let me know. Just like that effort, rarely ever actually is anyone going to come back and say, well, actually let's do, but it could happen. And honestly, it puts you front of mind, right? For the next time, maybe there's another game coming up that they happen to be doing, and if they had a pleasurable experience with talent, there's probably a really good chance that they would say, hey, I really liked working with this person. Let's reach out and see if they'd be interested in doing this other thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the second question, what is the thing you've done as an on-air talent that you're the least proud of?
I was casting a Counter-Strike match, and it's even hard to tell the story. So there was this team that, you know, went out late one night, and they were, you know, it was way late. They shouldn't have been out, right? And got into some trouble, met up with some unruly individuals. It was not a great situation. A couple of them got their wallets stolen, right? It was a wrong place at the wrong time type of deal. And I basically, during a Counter-Strike cast one time, I joked about it, and it was in the middle of a cast. It was kind of one of those things, you know, the chat laughed. It was funny. It came and it went. But one of the players that did that reached out to me and said, "Hey, Wheat, like, I am really unhappy that you, you know, that you made light of the situation." And, you know, I ended up having like an hour conversation with them, apologizing profusely. And it was a wake up call to me that, right, like, not everything is a joke and not everything should be joked about. And I think if there was, you know, this was like back in 2004, maybe. So it was a great lesson to learn very early on in my career that, right, I didn't have all the details. There was that story was like going around the event and whatnot. And it's one of those moments I think back on where it's like, I should have known better. Right. Mm-hmm. And it took, I felt so bad for the player. You know, I mean, what it boiled down to is they had some other kind of trauma that kind of was triggered by what happened. And I didn't respect that person. I didn't respect what happened to them. I didn't respect how they felt. And after that, I was like, this is a way to learn. We resolved things. Everything turned out really great. I was very appreciative that player like came and had that conversation with me. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure I've said some dumb stuff on cast, but like, that was the first time that I ever said something that like directly impacted another person. And I felt real, real bad about that. So that was probably it. And like I said, I think a lesson learned, and felt very fortunate that I was, able to learn that lesson. I did not feel good that it was at the cost of someone's feelings, but, you know, I was very thankful that they forgave me. And, I've kind of strived to make sure that I would never do that again. And if there was ever a situation where I felt someone was teetering on the line of it happening to them, I would try to, you know, pay it forward and right, pull them aside and say, "Hey, let me tell you a story so that you don't have to, right, run into this same experience, because it's not fun, and it doesn't help anyone."
Yeah, it's still hard to think about, you know, not just because that's what you said, but I think we've all been in maybe somewhat similar situations where maybe at the time we legitimately did not know it was an issue, or maybe we kind of knew, like maybe it was skirting a little bit, and then afterwards the person's like, "Hey," and you're like, sinking stomach feeling, "Oh no, like, right, that was definitely wrong. As you said, like, I knew better." And yeah, I think the most positive thing you can really take from is that, like, okay, well, now I know not to do it again. And it still sucks because you wake up in the middle of the night and you're just like, "Oh, that did not feel good 20 years later." But yeah, if you can take a positive experience from it, learn and give the information unto others, that's
absolutely what we can do. Absolutely.
Well, a nice little life lesson, I suppose, to end the podcast. But thank you again, DJ Wheat. This has been definitely, like, it's covered topics that I have not actually been able to even cover because you're one of how many people that I actually even know how to contact about the beginnings of esports, really. But then there's like so much extra detail. You're able to really sum things up really nicely. So I just really appreciate you coming on. I'm sure that the fans do as well. So, you said you're doing some stuff again on the weekends. Just where can people find you nowadays? Yeah. Since you're on the move a little bit.
Yeah. Well, first off, let me say thank you. I think it's great what you're doing. I was able to catch the interview that you did with Tasteless, and so keep up the good work. And I'm honored to have been invited and was able to come on. I find myself with a little bit more time these days, which is super exciting. I left my job at Twitch after 10 years, and I've just kind of been enjoying life a little bit, taking a bit of a break. The one thing that I have been casting on the regular for the last year and a half has been Quake Champions with id and Bethesda. You can find that over every Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/Quake. It's also on twitch.tv/Xbox. It's still some of the amazing players that I have been calling matches for over 20 years, as well as all of these incredible new players that are coming in, that it's sort of this awesome old blood, new blood storyline. And again, it's just another opportunity for me to tell stories. So I'd love if you'd tune in. Arena FPS is still absolutely one of my favorite things. That's also why I love StarCraft so much, because I love the one-on-one aspect of it and how that is truly the pinnacle of competitive gaming for me. But doing that, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DJ Wheat. I have been streaming a little bit more. That's on twitch.tv/DJ Wheat. And if you are interested in some of the kind of more historical aspects of esports, one of the things that I have been doing, and we're still very early on this, is that the 13-year birthday of Live on 3 was actually in January. And it seemed appropriate. I started that show because CGS had shut down and I was starting a new chapter in life. But it's a really exciting chapter because live streaming hadn't happened yet. StarCraft 2 wasn't released yet. League of Legends wasn't released yet. StarCraft 2 Street Fighter 4 wasn't released yet. So it's really awesome to kind of look through this lens and perspective of 13 years ago. So every Tuesday around 10 a.m., actually more like 11 a.m. Eastern, we're watching the old archives from 13 years ago. But it's an incredible insight. I thought I was going to cringe and hate it, but it is so fascinating to me. Hear us talking about topics that sometimes still exist in esports today, sometimes topics that have been resolved now or we know the answers to. Has a lot of open phones. You've been around in StarCraft. You remember Desro? You know,
yeah.
Desro?
Yeah.
Dude, Desro called into the very first episode of Live on 3 and talked about Dota. And I was like, oh my God, like I couldn't believe it, but it was so awesome. It was such a wholesome moment, and I'm super excited to rediscover all of those moments. So it's something obviously is super passionate about history as far as esports is concerned. So if you ever wanted a little peek inside, it might be a great way to do that. And I didn't mean to like shill as much as I just did, please. But I'm like so excited about watching these old 13-year-old videos about esports. So.
So that's completely awesome. I'm so excited because of it, actually. I'm definitely going to tune in. I feel like there is right now kind of a missing market, a little bit of the history of esports. Someone with more savvy than me is one day going to get people together and make documentaries and write books, but we're not quite there yet. So definitely be tuning in. Thank you again. Thank you, everyone, watching episode 43. I'll be back in 2 weeks with episode 44 and first or last, actually, for this episode. Big thank you to everyone who supports over on the Patreon, patreon.com/zombiegrub. Thank you to our co-producer, Shane, as well as to Nick, Venus, Steven, E.T., and Ravi for supporting the podcast. Hope you all enjoyed it, and I look forward to seeing you back here for episode 44.